In Vancouver, I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. 6 years ago this week, this program began, and now for the first time in audio form, I'm pleased to host this look back. This program now is, for all intents and purposes, what might be called a clip show. I haven't gone back to listen to all 190 hours and 531 programs, because frankly, that's a lot of time. I have gone back, though, and selected some cuts that have been noteworthy, perhaps interesting, as well as fun. And at that, there are so many other clips I'd have wanted to include. The mandate of the program, if there ever was one, has been to provide a convivial forum for conversation and discussion on a wide variety of subjects. And invariably, because the internet is what it is, I would have but one caveat as to the guests that would be invited. And that was they, or the subject at hand, was of interest to me. What follows, I hope, is a serviceable overview of the sort of guests that have appeared, as well as the sort of conversations that have broken out on this program over the last 6 years.
You interviewed Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah.
What was that like?
She was a very sexy woman to interview.
Really?
Yeah, which you would never think of. But what she had, and this is how I think she kept control over a lot of her cabinet, was... She would just lock her eyes on you, and you'd feel like you were the only man she talked to, like, in forever. And you would just, the power of that, and you know, the power of how she sort of did that was, I mean, there aren't many people that I couldn't speak, you know, I just lost myself in, but she was one of them. She just seemed to lock into you, and suddenly you were just sort of in her grip. And, you know, I used to say that to my buddies, and they used to think I was crazy, but she was a very sexy woman interview.
And you probably lost out to her, I bet.
Totally.
Really?
Completely, yeah.
That's the television anchor and journalist Kevin Newman on interviewing Margaret Thatcher. Here from May 2005 is the actor and comedian Dustin Diamond, best known for playing Screech on Saved by the Bell.
You'll live to be 80 years old and they'll still introduce you as Screech Powers. Are you sick of people asking you about the show?
Well, let's put it this way. You know, a lot of these child actors, they run and they hide from what made them household names. And, you know, I can understand both sides of the coin, having made myself a cultural icon of the 90s. You know, the problem is that these other guys don't know how to change their image. They don't know how they stress and strain and worry, and a lot of them get involved with drugs and everything else. Well, I've never had a drug problem. I've never robbed a bank or knocked over a liquor store. I've never been arrested. I mean, I'm young. Give me time. But you know, these guys don't know how to do anything else other than be stars, and that's hard when you're in the child star market. So I don't mind the Screech stuff at all. In fact, I talk about it in my comedy act. The thing is that, you know, if I wanted to do acting, well, Gilligan, everyone knows Bob Denver as Gilligan. Well, yeah, but he was bigger as Maynard G. Krebs before that. It just depends on what generation grew up watching him. But the thing is that I went into stand-up. I'm a comedy lover through and through, and stand-up is really the most raw form of entertainment. You know, you've got an audience, you've got a microphone, and that's it. It's just you in the spotlight and the crowd. There's no backup singers, no pyrotechnics, nothing. And you live and die by your jokes. I really enjoy it.
The first guest on the program was a friend from high school whose name is both irrelevant and unimportant. It is worth noting, however, who the first guest might have been. One of the first people offered to me early on was John Dean, the former White House counsel to Richard Nixon. Unfortunately, that booking fell through. I'm still fascinated by the Nixon era, and it was a great pleasure some years later to talk to the distinguished historian Margaret McMillan about her book on Richard Nixon going to China in 1974.
Chu Enlai admired your great-grandfather, and you mentioned that in the book. What's it like to find out that someone that you're writing about admired a relative of yours?
My great-grandfather is so far removed from me that I almost don't think of him like a relative. He's a figure in history. I was interested when I found out that Chu Enlai admired him. I thought it was an interesting choice. I think he admired Lloyd George, who was the Prime Minister of Britain at the end of the First World War, as someone who was quite cunning and quite good at negotiations, and that was certainly true of Chu Enlai himself.
We look back at the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall around its 20th anniversary with Michael Mayer. In 1989, he was Newsweek's correspondent covering the fall of the wall for the magazine. When I talked to him 20 years later, he was a director of communications for the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. There's a story in the book where you'd encountered, I guess it was a German soldier or a Russian soldier, I can't remember now, smoking a cigarette standing atop a pile of garbage, and he spit at you? Is that correct?
Yes, that's a good story. Thank you for remembering it. I was a Russian soldier.
Okay.
And I had been going around what was still East Germany after the wall came down, and Westerners, journalists were going all over because suddenly all the borders were open, and the Russians had, oh, 500,000 troops in the Red Army stationed in East Germany. Kind of made for some weird encounters. You'd be driving across, you know, a country road, and suddenly this line of tanks would come racing across the field, and they'd be flying the red flag of the Soviet Union. It was like being back in the middle of World War II. But in this case, the soldiers, I was trying to find some to talk to, and one man told me, well, go to the dump, because a lot of West Berlin stuff was dumped in the east. And here were these captains and colonels and lieutenants from the Red Army, you know, poking through stinking refuse, looking for bits of treasure to take back to the Soviet Union after conquering Nazi Germany. You know, in 1945, they were looking for their payback. And one of them had a bit of torn carpet under his arm and a teddy bear with one eye and, you know, a couple of other bits of stuff he'd salvaged. And, you know, he looked at me, and I had rented I had driven up in a rented red Mercedes convertible. And I got out of this thing and wanted to talk to him, and he took one look at me, took a drag on his cigarette, and then spat at my feet. You know, me, the symbol of my Western arrogance, we won the Cold War, forgetting, of course, that it was the Russians who fought from the gates of Moscow all the way to Berlin and played a huge role, of course, perhaps greater than even ours, in defeating Hitler.
What did you learn at that moment that he spit at you?
Humility.
Yeah.
You know, the dangers of myth-making.
Here now is the professional wrestler Bret Hart reflecting on his business and his own fate. This is from November 2007.
Well, why do you think that death has become so prevalent in your business?
You know, I don't know. It does seem that over the years there's been I don't know that you can put any blame on any particular thing, but there's a lot of wrestlers that developed prescription pill addictions that really went under the radar as far as drug testing was going, and you know, a lot of these guys got addicted to painkillers from injuries, and just going and going and going and going, and the whole rest of life is so you know, in a lot of ways it's so mundane, and you just get, all you have is the wrestlers and their lives, and it's just, you're just all chained together at the ankles, you're at the airports, you're in the dressing room, it's just this whole life that you live day in, day out, and it's really hard to escape it. And when you do escape it, you got to have enough money to support yourself. And most of these wrestlers, after they leave WWF, they're broke, they're beat up, they got addictions, they got alcohol problems, they got depression issues, and I think a lot of that's just sort of gone. You know, no one was paying attention, but when you see so many of them dropping off for all kinds of reasons, it just tells you this. I think that something, and aside from my brother Owen, I mean, most of them, you know, were sort of crazy drug deaths, most of them.
Are you surprised, or do you wonder why so many of them met an untimely fate, and you seem to have survived? Do you ever wonder why them and not you?
I don't know. I guess it's, you know, maybe my story wasn't finished. You know, I think of when I had my stroke, and I got my blessings every day at how close that was. I never realized for, I think, a long time until my doctor told me how close a stroke is to biting the bullet. I always thought that just the stroke itself was pretty severe.
The brilliant writer, best-selling author, comedian, and actor Tony Hendra was on the program April 2006 to discuss a new novel, The Messiah of Morris Avenue, which was set in his hometown of New York City. He reflects on New York and where it's headed.
Well, I think, you know, New York is New York. I think one of the reasons there was some practical reasons I said it in New York and I love New York. That's where I live. And I think New York is likely to become possibly more and more isolated or would become more and more isolated culturally in every other way if a southern-driven theocracy actually took hold or took even stronger hold than it already has. So New York, I would think, is a bastion of resistance, and that's kind of the way I see it. But a lot of it has to do with, trends that are already, in place. Trump is perhaps an easy target, but I certainly do posit that, what I regard as his real estate predations have worked their way up the Hudson, this wonderful, splendid, glorious river which we're lucky enough to live beside, so you can't see the damn thing unless you live in one of his towers, that's already happening in the Upper West Side. So it's that kind of thing. But on the other hand, I do think that as I call them, the Faith, Hope, and No Charity Brigade, meaning the Christian right, would have no sympathy whatsoever with any of the urban poor, so that the Bronx would be even more dilapidated than it already is.
The magnificent satirist Christopher Buckley wrote a marvelous memoir on his parents William F. Buckley Jr. and Patricia Taylor Buckley. His father, the noted conservative commentator and prominent Catholic, had wanted to have his ashes rest in a bronze crucifix that would stand in front of their Connecticut home. How tall was it?
Well, it was about 6 feet tall. It was a bronze crucifix, very artistic. He commissioned it from a sculptor named Jimmy Knowles, who was a wonderful sculptor. And he put it smack in the middle of Mom's rose garden, which didn't please her. And the idea was that their ashes, after they died, would go inside the cross and would remain there for all eternity. And Mom, and Pop would talk about this sort of longingly, almost, at the dinner table. Oh, Ducky, isn't it wonderful that our ashes will be together? And Mom was having none of this, and she would lean over and whisper to me, "Just send me out with the garbage, or send me out with the tide. I most certainly do not wish to spend eternity in that object." But Mom went first, so she went into the cross, and then. But I had this dilemma, see, because I was pretty sure I wouldn't be able to hold on to the house after death taxes and all the rest. As just about a month before, I thought, what's going to happen with the cross? So about a month before Pup died, I didn't really want to pester him with this because but it was a logistical imperative, you might say. And I said, Pop, I know you want your ashes in the cross after you're gone. He said, oh, I absolutely want them in the cross. I said, yeah, no, I know. I was just thinking, what if I had to, sell the house? And he looked at me and said, your point being? And I said, a new owner might not want a 6-foot-high crucifix in the garden. And he said, why not? It's a work of art. I said, it is absolutely a work of art. But, the new owner might be, Jewish or Muslim, Amish.
Yeah.
He didn't want to talk about it. So I said, we don't have to talk about it. So when he died, I made an executive decision and decided not to cremate him, but I'm Irish, and we Irish sort of have a thing about the body, and so you can have a wake, an excuse to have a last drinks party. And so I put Mom's ashes in the coffin with him, along with a jar of peanut butter. He loved peanut butter, and the TV remote control, which I knew would make him happy for all eternity, since he loved to hold on to that TV remote control. And so they're together in this cemetery in Sharon, Connecticut, where he grew up, and the cross is right there next to them.
Do you think you'd have been pleased by what happened?
I think it was, well, no. because those were his absolute wishes. But I think given the reality, you know, I feel at peace with the solution. And it made the family, the Buckley family, happy to have him back in Sharon, where he grew up. And his, you know, four of his sisters are buried there, so he's kind of where he belongs, and Mom is there with him on his lap. So I think it was an elegant solution. Yeah.
Here's the comedian Lauren Weedman, formerly of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. She'd just written a book on that experience, which was less than pleasant.
Is it harder, do you think, for a woman to be funnier than a man?
Yeah, I don't think it's as much. It's not as and it's not that you don't really want I always have this feeling like when a girl walks in the room, people aren't like, God, I hope she's hilarious. Like I always feel like that people when a girl walks in is like, I hope she's either going to be my mother, my mistress, like they want different things from the ladies, and humor is not always one of them. And because I would walk into environments where everybody else was like on The Daily Show or other comedy environments, where everyone's like, I can't, I won't be crude, but like, you know, telling crude jokes and being really nasty and being really like just very free and over the top. And I'd walk in like, okay, you ready to play? Like, I wanted to play too. And suddenly I'd make the exact same joke. And coming out of my mouth, they were like, whoa, Lauren, anyway, so how was your weekend? Like, you know, they didn't want me to play in that same level. So I think it is harder for, and plus women, at least I'm much more of a emotions rule a lot of my day and my night, actually, and that's harder.
Do you think Jon Stewart liked you?
I had someone the other day come up to me after a show, a solo show, come up to me and say, who worked with me, and she was like, what if he, like, you know, I think it was a crush, I think he really had a crush, and she was kind of kidding. And then I also tell people all the time, like, it was so hard because he was so in love with me. What do you do about that awkward situation? He was married. I don't know if he liked me. I'm not sure. I think that I try to imagine what I was, like, when I'm trying to get something done, like, if I'm in charge of a job, if I'm the head honcho of a situation, and someone comes in who's super hyper and so thrilled to be there that they won't shut up, I won't hate that person, but they will tend to, you know, you will sort of be like, calm down, bring it down a level. And I think he liked me okay. No, he didn't like me, I don't think, actually.
Was he the same off the air as he was on the air?
No. Do you think he listens to your show?
I don't think so.
Okay, well then no, he was completely different. There, it's out. No, he's the only, the thing that would, because I don't want to, because, you know, the whole thing of like, oh, he's so self-deprecating, like, you know, we're just a little cable show, we're just a bunch of little guys doing a little funny thing, you know, like, it's not a big deal. But he knows there's no way not to know he's got that kind of power. And things were really ratcheting up when I got on the show. Like, 9/11 had just happened, so things were getting, things were getting hilarious. 9/11 had just happened. No, but things had gotten really, you know, and he was basically, like, winning. His office was full of awards, and things were getting more and more intense for him. You know, the power he was having.
You were on the show at a time when Stephen Colbert and Steve Carell were on the show.
Yeah,
correct?
The Steves, I know.
And what was it like to work with them?
That was good. That was all good. I liked them a lot. I mean, the Stephen Carell is, super polite, super nice. He's like an actor. He's a comedy actor. Like, he's one of those people that off camera is not super on. Like, I always approached him, too. Like, he'd be, like, super fun to play with. Or be like, hey, Steve. And he'd be like, and how are you? How was your week? You know, and he was very sort of formal and nice, but really, really sweet, kind, good, you know, good guy. And Stephen Colbert was much more of a hyperactive, like, bad kid. But fun. I don't mean bad, but, you know, the good, fun, bad kid. The one you want to sit next to, but much more exactly how he is on, you know, not that character he plays, but very hyper and very... That was a really... It was a totally fun time, but I did feel sort of there was no other girl. Like, the only other women that worked on the show was, like, the makeup lady, you know, or the guy that, or the one woman who, like, would get the lint off of John's jacket before he went on the air. Super hard job she had.
Despite 6 years of doing this, I'm by no means an expert at interviewing, nor am I qualified to give a lecture on the art of the conversation. One of the people for whom this program has stolen a lot from is Don Imus. Doing this, you can't help but become a fan of good interviewing on radio and television. I have been very pleased in the life of this show to welcome three of the finest interviewers in Canada. They're the best: Ken Rockburn, Eleanor Wachtel, and Steve Paikin. First, Ken Rockburn, on whether there's a difference between interviewing on radio and television.
Oh, God, yes. For one thing, there's the makeup, and I can't tell you what a pain that is. I've never gotten used to it. I've never gotten used to having to sit down and get makeup put on, and they do, you know, and they want to put hairspray on you, and I refuse to let that happen. And anyway, I have this ongoing battle with the woman who does makeup. But there's also I'm painfully aware of my drawbacks when I'm working in television, because, and when you said it's obvious that I come from a radio background, one of the physical giveaways of that is that I far too often put my hand to my mouth. And you should never do that in television. And I do it all the time, because in radio, it's kind of a, I don't want to say it's a trick, but it's a, in some instances, when I was doing radio interviews, if you ask a question of somebody, and then you kind of lean your chin on your hand, or do something like that, you look more thoughtful and serious, and it has an effect on the guest and what the guest is going to say to you. But I do it in television, and I realize when I do watch myself, and I try not to because it makes me uncomfortable, but when I do watch myself, I notice that I do it a lot, and I shouldn't be. In fact, I'm doing it right now, and I shouldn't be doing it at all.
The other thing that I notice, and this sounds stupid, but I mean, I'll bring it up anyway, you wear a lot of pins on TV this
day. Oh, I've always had pins. There are some people who like that, and there are some people who just can't stand it. But
yeah, I was just wondering what people think about that.
Well, it's interesting. I have dozens of them, and I started collecting them a couple of decades ago. Actually, I bought the first one when I was in New Orleans in the early 80s with my wife, and I just saw one that I really liked, and it happened to be a fish, and I bought it. And then it's gathered over the years. I bought some, and then other people bought them as gifts. I actually have one that I wear that Patty Torsney, who was an MP, isn't anymore, but that she sent me because she saw that I wore pins, and sent me this great fish pin. I got a package once, this is about 3 years ago, at CPAC in the mail from a woman in Iqaluit, and she sent me, and I still wear them actually, two very nice ivory pins. One was an Inuit drummer, and the other one was a jumping whale, and they're lovely. So, but there are other people who, you know, think I'm some kind of faggot.
Eleanor Wachtel has been honored with countless awards and the Order of Canada for her work. She's been interviewing authors on CBC Radio for well over 20 years now, and her show Writers and Company is by far the most prestigious literary program in the country. From October of 2009, Eleanor Wachtel.
Is there a preference when you interview someone? Like, do you like doing it over the phone? Do you like doing it in person? Or do you like having an audience in front of you?
Probably my favorite is in person without an audience. Generally with an audience is fine, but I think I like the intimacy of just the face-to-face, the one-on-one in a room together.
And the reading, you obviously have to do a lot of reading for your job. Do you find that you have time to read for pleasure?
Not generally during what I'd call the school year.
Yeah.
But I find most of what I read, because I can choose who I'm interviewing, most of what I'm reading is a pleasure, but it is also for work. I joke that I can only read dead authors in the summer, because,
yeah.
You know. But then last summer I even found myself reading some new novels that were coming out to try to decide whether to do interviews. So I don't get tired of reading, but I do read a lot, and I have I'm actually a relatively slow reader, so it's an occupational shortcoming. But it's often the first thing I'll do on vacation is read something, just read a quick novel to sort of feel like I'm on holiday.
Do you have more? You obviously have more than one book going at a time, do you?
I try not to do that.
Really?
I'm sort of a fairly linear person, and I prefer to just go from what, you know, as far, you know, what, beginning, end of each one. And also, if I look, I don't want to get mixed up about plots or people's biographies, or so sometimes it's difficult if I'm doing a special series and I have to prepare a whole bunch of interviews at once, or during something like this time of year when there's an author's festival and I'll be doing four interviews in a row. It's a struggle to just sort of keep it all focused and separate. But I prefer to keep to do one book at a time.
Now, do you read anywhere, or is there a specific place you have to read?
Oh, no, no. You have to. If you have to read as much as I do, you have to be able to read anywhere.
Do you use a Kindle or any of these electronic things?
No, I'm curious about it because when I do go on vacation in the summer, it's usually, you know, one suitcase for books and one for clothes. So a Kindle, you know, would be a potential great advantage, but I haven't tried it out yet. I actually, just on the show this week, was talking to Robert Darnton, who's talks not so much, but he's an historian, but he's also an historian of the book, so he's been looking at the versions of the book, past, present, and future, going from scrolls to Gutenberg and movable type to what he calls codex, which is basically books, and then, of course, online. I think I'll try it sometime. The screens keep getting better, and maybe I'll just wait till they get better.
Steve Paikin has been on the program three times. He is one of the country's finest journalists and one of the nicest I've encountered. He's done me the great favor of appearing on the program twice, right after moderating the Federal Leaders' debates in 2006 and 2008. What was the feeling like in the room? You mentioned a couple of years ago when you were here that it was quite tense that night in Montreal.
It was absolutely different, and it's interesting you remember that. Yes, leading up to 8 o'clock, which it was in 2006, there was, you know, the nervousness in the room, the tension was, you know, pull out your cliche, it was so thick you could have cut it with a knife. And I remember trying to tell a lame joke at about 1 minute before 8 o'clock in 06 just to get everybody to relax a little bit more. Last night, Elizabeth May and Stephen Harper were sort of chuckling jovially between each other before the debate started. Stéphane Dion, I think, was sort of sitting off on his own, but Jack Layton and Gilles Duceppe were exchanging banter just before the 9 o'clock hour approached, and they kept playing this music on the floor, which is this big, you know, ponderous, pompous, lots of timpani, lots of trumpets coming on, and the more and more that music was playing, the more and more I could see that the kind of light mood that I think being around a table helps create, was being jeopardized. And so I said to the control room, God, can we turn this music off? This is just, you know, making everybody nauseous. And to his credit, Freddie Parker, the director, did do that. They turned the music off, and everybody kind of breathed a sigh of relief. And for the remaining few minutes leading up to the debate, there was, I would say, a much easier, much less tense atmosphere leading up to the beginning.
That's Steve Paikin, the morning after the Federal Leaders' debate in 2008. The discussion of politics and current affairs, Canadian or otherwise, is a mainstay of this program. American politics is frequently discussed as well as it is here with one of my favorite guests, the political strategist Warren Kinsella. I watch Glenn Beck a lot, so I'm wondering...
You shouldn't do that.
No, I shouldn't, no. I'm wondering how Obama's working out for you.
Well, I love him. I am unabashedly in love with Barack Obama. You know, if you saw my office here in Toronto where I'm speaking to you from, I've got more Obama paraphernalia than probably any other Canadian. So he is, I think, doing an amazing job. Anybody who can survive the most brutal recession the United States has ever gone through and then push through something like health care reform and completely emasculate the Republican Party in the way that he did. You know, he gave them an opportunity to compromise, and they blew him off. And so not only has he survived the recession politically, he's going to have health care. So at this point, you know, in the midterms, is he going to lose some seats in Congress and Senate? You know, for sure, but every president does. The question is whether he loses so many that he loses the balance of power. But at the end of the day, he's got health care reform, and any legislative attempts by the Republicans to overturn it are going to be stopped now by a presidential veto. So, I mean, he changed history, and, you know, for a guy who was supposedly politically weak because of the recession, that's pretty impressive.
One of the first political figures to appear on the program in the early days of the show in 2004 was the former Liberal cabinet minister Sheila Copps.
She had just published her memoirs. From November 2004, I asked Copps how she would bring more females and more minorities into the political life of Canada.
Well, I think one of the things you have to do is actually have a target. And in the book, I explain how in 1993, I actually went to the Prime Minister in 1991 and I said, look, we've got a chance to form the government. Let's change the face of Parliament. And so we actually had a target of 25% women candidates, and I was given the responsibility of going across the country to recruit them and work with provincial presidents. And in one election, we doubled the number of women. You need targets. You need objectives. You need deliverables. You can't just talk about it. I mean, in the last election, Mr. Martin actually made the ridiculous statement that he was going to have 50% women candidates without anything to back it up, just to say it. And then we ended up with fewer women in Parliament and fewer women actually running for all the parties in the last election than when we formed the government in 1993.
Soon after Sheila Copps was on the show, I was pleased to have Deborah Gray on the program. She was the Reform Party's first MP and for a time was the leader of the official opposition, one of the first females to occupy that seat in the House of Commons. In this clip, we talk about faith, and I brought up a misdeed from her youth.
But you stole a Bible from a church once when you were a young girl, right?
I was 13 years old, going to Camp Homewood over on Vancouver Island, and I had my little list of things that I was supposed to take along to camp. Okay, sleeping bag, check. Flashlight,
right.
Check. That would be just fine. Bible, and I thought, ooh, I can't check that. I don't have a Bible. So I thought, well, you know, where do you get a Bible? You go to the church, and that made perfect sense to me. I'm always practical, and so I rode my bicycle up to the church at St. Mary's Anglican Church at 37th and Large,
right.
And went in. The church was open. I went in, and there were just piles of Bibles there, so I thought, well, I'll just take that. So I took it, and then went back home, went to my little camp list, and thought, okay, Bible, check, got that, and there it was.
Bill Vanderzam was a colorful figure in British Columbian and Canadian politics. He's still making news, what with his campaign against the HST. Here he is from March 2009, when he just published his memoirs discussing faith and politics. And you write in the book that anyone with faith who can check their faith at the door isn't worth their faith at all. And Paul Martin was the one who said that he was able to do that. You don't think that was true, that he was able to do that, do you?
No. I don't think you can park your faith unless the faith doesn't mean a whole lot to you. You can't park it at the door. It goes with you. It comes with you. And you know, those that say they have no faith, there's no such thing. Every void gets filled with something. So it may not be a religious belief of one kind or another, but there's always something that fills the void. So everyone has their biases. Everyone has their favoritisms. There's no question about that, and that's okay. That's why you have election campaigns. You ask the questions. It comes out. If you don't like it, you don't vote for the person. And I made no secret of it.
So can the atheist, can the agnostic, can they be a good leader?
I find it very difficult. I think you have to have hopefully a set of values that is visible and acceptable to the majority of people. Someone who's, of course, I don't believe there are that many atheists. Again, I think there's a void that gets filled with something, and it may not be the God that you or I or any of the people listening have, but it's certainly something that is their God. So can they be good leaders? I suppose there are those that, if they have other qualities that come to the fore during that term at the time, they could probably or possibly do a fair job, but I think it's more difficult.
One of the architects of this current regime in Ottawa and the success of Stephen Harper is Tom Flanagan. He ran four campaigns for Harper, two for the leadership of two political parties, as well as the 2004 and 2006 federal election campaigns. He was on the program to talk about a book he just published in October 2007, which chronicled those campaigns.
How much did luck play into your successes in the four campaigns that you ran?
Luck was important. Just to give one example, bad luck. It wasn't bad luck. It was a breakdown in procedure. I was going to say the child porn fiasco in 2004, but that wasn't bad luck. That was a mistake, breakdown of internal procedure.
Well, good luck would be in 2006 or end of 2005 when the Mounties announced they were going to investigate Ralph Goodale and his office for a possible leak in connection with their income trust taxation proposal. You know, we didn't bring that about. You know, it was all what the Liberals had done combined with the NDP asking for an investigation. Yet it certainly helped our campaign. So, yeah, luck's important. But I would also say that good strategists tend to be lucky. And the reason for that is that over a period of time, everybody gets a mix of good and bad luck. I think it's random. You might have runs of good luck and runs of bad luck, but over a long period of time, it probably is going to even out. But the difference is that a good strategist knows how to minimize the losses incurred from bad luck and knows how to take advantage of the opportunities presented by good luck.
The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq remain in the minds of many. In the fall of 2009, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Finkel from the Washington Post had just published a stirring book, The Good Soldiers, which followed a group of troops leading the surge in Iraq in 2007. From November 2009, David Finkel and I discussed the men and women he covered as they went to war. Do you find that these 19-year-olds that go over there, that they're emotionally prepared for battle?
Who could be prepared for what happened over there? I'd love to say yes, but I don't think anyone was prepared for what happened during that 14-month period. They, like I said, they went to a tough area, and it was just luck of the draw that they ended up there. And when they, after they adjusted and thought they were doing well, and then they began receiving injuries, and then soldiers began dying, and then more soldiers were injured, and more soldiers died, of course that changes your outlook about everything.
And their view of the mission, did they understand it going in?
They seemed to. They said they did. They were pretty gung-ho about the thing. They wanted to be there. But by the end, much less so.
And they tell you that, of course.
Sure, but yeah. That's one of the things that developed over time. As they began to seek me out privately to talk to me about what was going on in their own minds, about what they were seeing, what they were encountering, what they were feeling. I think I became a useful person for them to talk to privately. And when I say privately, they understood it was for a book, but it was away from a group, and it was a chance for them to talk out loud about what they were seeing and contending with. And again, it was some pretty severe stuff.
Janice Grostein, who's one of the country's leading foreign policy analysts at the University of Toronto, was on the program with Eugene Lang to discuss the war in Afghanistan and Canada's involvement therein. Lang was chief of staff to two Canadian ministers of defense after September 11th and in the run-up to the conflict there and in Iraq. Their book published in the fall of 2007 is a great primer on the conflict. Here we discuss war and politics with regards to Iraq.
The American government, the Bush administration, what were they expecting of Canada with regards to the Iraq conflict?
Certainly the Bush administration at the political level, as people like Donald Rumsfeld, President Colin Powell and others fully expected and desired Canada's political support for the American intervention in Iraq, whether or not it was authorized by the United Nations. But it was made clear to the then Defense Minister, John McCallum, who I worked for. We had a meeting with Rumsfeld within about 6 or 7 weeks of the outbreak of the Iraq War, where Rumsfeld made it clear that he was not expecting or necessarily desiring an army, infantry, or ground force contribution from Canada to the invasion of Iraq. Rumsfeld made it clear that he wanted, or he preferred that Canada concentrate its efforts in Afghanistan, and in particular in leading the ISAF mission in Kabul, which at that time was confined to Kabul.
Why has the story then sort of run away from that with regards to Iraq and sort of not supporting allies? Why has that come out, do you think?
I think generally because the debate got muddied by the press. In the run-up to the Iraq War, the issue that was debated in the press, if you go back and look at some of the columns that were being written at the time, the question was, were we going to war with the United States? That was never the issue, as we show in the book. The issue really was, would we support the war that the United States was about to engage in? And here Prime Minister Chrétien was adamant. His instincts were really visceral on this. He was not going to support that war. But that's different from the debate that most people think we had, which was, would we go to war with the United States?
And if you look back at that, you may recall that it was referred to by Washington as the Coalition of the Willing. And that coalition, I think, comprised something like 30 countries at one point. And very few of those countries actually had ground forces in Iraq. But they were politically supporting the American effort, and they may have been providing other token military contributions, naval contributions, air contributions, this sort of thing. But there weren't, I think there were many countries on that so-called coalition of the willing list that had virtually no troops in Iraq.
Many other noted thinkers and academics have appeared on the program over the years. As someone who never finished school, it's been both rewarding and stimulating to get to talk about big issues like conflict and the Arctic with Michael Byers, or global warming with folks like Andrew Weaver, Mark Jackard, and Gwyn Dyer. Richard Florida is a high-profile academic from the University of Toronto who's done a lot of work on cities and livability. When he arrived from the United States for a teaching position here, he was greeted as a bit of a rock star.
I was astonished at how much was written about you and your move to Toronto last year. Why do you think that was, and did you welcome the attention?
It was overwhelming, and I think my wife said it best. My wife, Rana, said, I don't quite understand why they think you're all that. She said a few other choice things, but it keeps me grounded. I think there's obviously a sense of great elation among Torontonians and Canadians that our time in Canada has come. And I think what people are going through is, Fareed Zakaria just wrote this interesting book called The Post-American World.
Right.
I think that what's happening in Canada, in Toronto and Vancouver, Montreal, but the big cities principally, but Canada as a whole, is this real sense of what are we going to do in a post-American world? You know, America was this big, giant country with all this wealth. And Canadians in the past, you know, my Canadian friends talked about the brain drain. And now all of a sudden, people from all over the world are choosing Canada, and then Americans. I know it sounds so ludicrous to folks listening in, but, you know, some of the world's greatest scientists who used to work in America are now choosing to come to Canada. And people are saying, well, what's happening? And welcoming with open arms as a sense of, we're on the map. I think we're more than on the map in Canada. I think the time has come. And with resources, with natural resources, with great coastal cities, with this great east-west thing we have going on, I think that, and with a relatively small country with a growing population that's relatively affluent. So I think I was a representation of this adaptation, this move in a quote-unquote post-American-centric world. And I think there's a sense of growing up. What worries me is that there's still a little bit of humility. Now, I love the humility. It's a little bit of humility, a little bit of insecurity, a little bit of looking to New York and London, or, you know, Tokyo or Shanghai for ideas. I think we got the ideas. I think we in Canada, in these great cities, are poised on the cusp. We have the resources. I think we've got to stand up and build world models. It's not enough to say Vancouver is going to be a great city for Vancouverites. It's not enough to say Toronto is going to be a great city for Torontonians. You got to say, now we're going to build world models, because there's so many people back in the States that are saying we need a model, and so many people all over Europe and Asia and the rest of the world that are saying we need a model. I think it's our time to get up and engage the world on our terms and say, no, no, no. We are building the next phase of great cities, great communities, people-centered, inclusive, diverse, tolerant, socially aware places. And I think Canada just has that feeling, that reputation in the world. So that would be my one challenge. Let's get up and stand up and say, you know, we're no longer the little brother. And in fact, we're a big, strong, strapping teenager and young adult. We're ready to show the world what kind of model we can provide.
Frans de Waal was once named by Time magazine as one of the world's most influential people. He is a primatologist from Emory University who has looked at human behavior, looking at the behavior of primates. Here's a small portion of our interview from October 2009.
I'm particularly interested in the complex forms where animals show an understanding of the situation of somebody else. And only a few animals do that, like apes do it, the dolphins, elephants, and of course humans, after a certain age. Because interestingly, when humans are very young, a two-year-old child doesn't have the complex empathy that you would expect in a human. So that still has to develop. So to give an example of complex empathy, in a chimpanzee colony at a zoo in Sweden, there was a young chimpanzee who got a rope around its neck and it was choking, and it would die if no one did something. But the highest ranking male went over to the juvenile and picked him up, so it took the pressure off the rope by picking him up with one arm, and with his other hand, which was free, he unwrapped the rope carefully from the neck, and then he put down the juvenile. It's a very interesting response because, first of all, that he's interested in helping, which is the empathy response right there. But second, there's an intelligence to it. He could also have been pulling at the juvenile, which would have been a stupid thing to do because he would have killed it. But he lifted it up and unwrapped the rope, and that's what I call targeted helping responses, and you see those in some animals, but they're actually unusual in the animal kingdom. And those kind of helping responses show you a sort of empathy that you're going to find in humans also.
Deborah Tannen is a professor of linguistics at Georgetown and frequently appears on radio and television. Her previous books, You Just Don't Understand and You're Wearing That, were a huge bestseller. She's the youngest of three sisters. I'm pleased to welcome to the Planta Online program Deborah Tannen. Good morning, Professor Tannen.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
I'm so pleased to be here.
You're an only... I'm an only child. You have two older sisters.
Right.
And I'm wondering sometimes for myself, am I missing something not having a sibling?
Yeah, you're missing some good and some bad. I like to tell this story. I was talking to a woman in a kind of a gathering, and there was another bunch of women gathered around, and one of the women was saying how much she adores her sister. Oh, we can't get enough of each other. We just keep laughing and talking. I'm her lifeline. She's my lifeline. And one of the women there said, I always wished I had a sister. I'm an only child, and I always felt bad about that. Well, I thought this sounded so great. I arranged to interview that woman, and she started by telling me she had just gone through a year of not talking to her sister. That's not what the she was putting forth, and that the woman who was an only child was feeling envious of. I wish I had wished I could go back and tell her a sister can be the most comforting, most wonderful one word, and she can set you laughing. You share your history. She knows exactly what your parents were like. The person you can call on when anything is wrong, all of these things are the positive side. But then there's also someone who has access to your history and your past and can misrepresent it. She can take your things. She can break them. if she isn't there when you need her, it hurts more than if a friend wasn't there when you needed her. So there are both sides.
That was Deborah Tannen, a professor from Georgetown and best-selling author, who was on the program September 2009 talking about siblings, namely her recent book on the relationship between sisters, You Are Always Mom's Favorite. The author and philosopher John Ralston Saul was on the program October 2008. Here he is talking about the Canadian elite, Conrad Black, and colonialism.
We hate the idea that there's an elite, but at least our elite is mainly not inherited, you know, it's not inherited money or power. It is in a few cases in terms of money, but not that many. Basically, when people have power and authority, it's you know, you can choose another word. If people in charge, does that make you happier? You know, I mean, they are the elite. So it's a premier, it's a cabinet, it's a Supreme Court, it's broadcasters, it's writers, it's people in positions of influence and authority and power.
Would you consider yourself as a member of that elite?
I think I would be kind of hypocritical if I didn't, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Have you discussed in the book Conrad Black and that his behavior feeds into this colonial mindset that the elite that you talk about in the book sort of has?
Yeah, very briefly, because he's not that interesting.
No, but this colonial mindset that we have in this country.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is very interesting that this late in the day, there's two things. One is the sort of stupid thing, which shows just how mediocre the man is and always was, and how colonial, that he actually thought it was a good idea to give up his Canadian citizenship in order to become a member of an absolutely meaningless and decadent British structure, the House of Lords. Just at the moment, of course, when the one tiny bit of power it still had was being removed, so it was even more ridiculous to do it. And, of course, by making that colonial misjudgment, he now finds himself in jail in the United States without the possibility of coming to Canada. So, but the more interesting thing is that the people who write about business in Canada have spent an inordinate amount of time over the last 15 years writing about this man, endlessly, including defending him during the trial in every detail, everything he says is written down. And the fact is, he's become the sort of the image and voice of capitalism in Canada. But he's one of the most unsuccessful capitalists of his generation. He only ever created one thing, a newspaper, which he couldn't hold on to for more than 3 years. Everything else he did was really about stripping companies down, stripping them out, and taking the cash. He didn't build wealth or create wealth. And so, in a way, by focusing on him, they've done damage to the way in which Canadians think about capitalism, because he's such a bad example of a capitalist. You know, a failed example, an uninteresting example, and an unpleasant example. Remember, this is one of the big advocates of libel chill, right? In other words, suing people in order to prevent them from saying things about you that you don't like, because right. They don't have the money to fight you, fight back. It's called libel chill. And he was one of the great advocates of it. He used it regularly. And he would say, you know, I was justified. They had to apologize. They apologized because he couldn't afford to go on fighting. So let's not talk any more about him, because he isn't that interesting.
No, but I want to...
You know, I'd rather, if you're going to talk about capitalists, then we should talk about the real capitalists, which, you know, and you can like them, you can dislike them, but, you know, the Baudouins, the Bombardiers, the Desmarais, the Power Corporation, Peter Munk. You start going through this list. These are, you know, these are... You can dislike or like their politics, but at least they are real representatives of the free market.
I'll get to the economic crisis in just a sec, but I want to just come back to the point. I pulled a review off your website, the Ottawa Citizen Review, of this book. And
it wouldn't be a review, it's probably an article. I think.
Right, yeah. Anyway, so the person there wrote that it's ironic that you criticize Black while your wife held the ultimate colonial job in Canada as Governor General, that you were known as His Excellency during that time. How do you respond to that?
Oh, it's not difficult at all. You know, in Canada is a country where there are very few, you know, honorifics. As it happens, you know, the vice regal couple are called Excellency while they're there. There's nothing particularly, you know, remarkable about that. It's just, that's what it is, and the day you leave, it stops. You know, so it's not you, it's the position.
The most frequent guest on the program over the years has been Rafe Mayer. He's been on 7 times, and I hope many more. I could probably do a program of clips just of his appearances here. There's no broadcaster in this province and in this country who I've admired more. He's also a hell of a nice guy. Here from October 2004, Rafe Mayer on Winston Churchill.
You're both late bloomers. You both are, you know, strong convictions in your political thinking. Were you drawn to him because of that, because of the similarities, or is it just a coincidence that there were similarities between the two of you?
I think it's a coincidence. First of all, you know, Churchill could hardly be called a late bloomer. I mean, he was a famous war correspondent before the Civil War, Boer War, covering the Spanish-American War in 1898. He entered Parliament in 1900, and he was at that time 26 years of age. And he held very substantial portfolios all the time that whatever party he belonged to was in office. I think really what my attraction to Churchill really is the character. The man had character, and he had enormous ability to lead. And I think most importantly at all, he was able to marshal the English language so that it conveyed that leadership to ordinary people. I don't model myself after Churchill. That would be stupid. I know Churchill, never could be. I don't look any bit like him in my career or otherwise. But he was able to talk to the British people in a way they understood. If you listen to what he had to say, he talked during the war. He talked in Shakespearean language because he knew that the public in Britain understood that language. For example, he never talked about bad news. He talked about heavy tidings. He talked the kind of language where people stopped what they were doing and listening and showed enormous leadership. So I think really I don't connect myself in any way to Churchill. I just think that he's one of the world's great leaders, certainly the greatest in the 20th century, and we don't see anything like it today.
The author Denise Chong now on Being Canadian. My parents are Filipino and I was born here.
Yeah.
And I don't feel a particular attachment to the country of my parents. When you lived in China, did you You lived there for a while, a couple of years, few years. Did you feel anything in terms of a closeness to the country because your ancestors were from there?
In a word, no. No. If anything, it reinforced my sense that I was Canadian. I tried to feel something, if only because all good wishes that were sent with me suggested that I should, you know, lift up my feet and find my Chinese roots.
Right.
And no, if anything, it reinforced my sense of being, my staunch sense of being Canadian. That said, I did meet family. And family, there's a complexity, of course, to family that you feel an attachment to. And so yes, that reach across continents and generations happened with family. But when I come back to Canada, that to me is what Canada makes Canada, you know, I'd rather have a complicated life or citizenship than a simple one. And that's what makes Canada so wonderful. You can have this, you can or cannot have an attachment, say, to your Filipino ancestry or my Chinese ancestry, and still maintain a fierce attachment to being Canada. And it still makes you equally, it doesn't take away from being Canadian.
Gossip eventually becomes news, and they say that journalism is the first draft of history. Kenneth White was on in November 2008 to promote his magnificent biography of William Randolph Hearst. Some 100 years after the fact, we do a bit of gossiping about Hearst's competitor, Joseph Pulitzer. One of the things that that caught me early on when you were discussing Pulitzer and his, I guess he got married. Some guy went with him on his honeymoon. And then you discuss this later in the book. You mentioned Pulitzer's sexuality.
Well, I'm glad that you noticed that, because nobody else has asked me about it. But he was an odd duck, Pulitzer. He did have a very close relationship with, I think his name was John McCullough, an actor. And he took the guy along on his honeymoon with Mrs. Pulitzer, which was a bit unusual, to say the least. And then all through his later years, even though he had a family and he fathered a number of children, and his relationships with Mrs. Pulitzer were often, as far as you can tell from his letters, warm and cordial, he lived apart from her and the family for most of the year, and traveled in the company of male secretaries, many of whom were young and single and would be lifelong bachelors. And I don't have any hard evidence, any real evidence to say that his sexuality was unusual. I just found it curious that people are always writing about Hearst and Hearst's relationships and intimate relationships, and there's been very little curiosity about Pulitzer's when in many ways he lived the more unconventional lifestyle.
In Toronto this day, please welcome to the Planta Online program Ricardo Larrivé. Bon matin, Monsieur Larrivé.
Hey, thank you very much for having me with you.
You're very welcome. Now, I saw your program on Radio Canada the other day, and that I was so impressed with the kitchen.
my kitchen, yes. Well, you know what? It started with a sad story. 2 years ago, my wife had breast cancer. And I announced to CBC, I said, you know what, I need to be close to my family. If you want me to be on air, I'm going to build a bigger kitchen with everything I need to shoot the show in my house. And they said yes. So we have this dream kitchen in my house where we can actually shoot everything, French or English, for here or for Europe, for anything we do, and it's a lot of fun, because if I'm done at 5, at 5:15, I'm in the garden with the girls.
That's the television personality Ricardo Larrivé, one of the most popular on French-language television, as well as English-speaking Canada, who appeared on the program June 2009. The Globe and Mail's Ian Brown was on to discuss his wonderful memoir on his son Walker and the condition that affects him. The book has deservedly won many prizes. Here's Mr. Brown from October 2009. What is the name of this genetic condition? How do you pronounce it?
It's cardio for the heart problems it causes. C
facio for the facial dysmorphia, that it, the sort of disfigurement in the face. These kids tend to have no eyebrows. That's actually one of the most salient, that's how they spot it. Lower and rotated ears, sort of a crinkled bridge on their nose, you know, down slanted eyes, etc. That's the facio. And then cutaneous pertains to their skin, which tends to be dry and very, very sensitive. One of the symptoms of the syndrome is a real allergy to new stimuli. If you touch these kids, they freak out. If new noises, new stuff like that freaks out, at least when they're very, very young. They think it has to do with the wiring, and the brain is not complete, and so any new information causes a kind of information overload. So that's how you get cardiofaciocutaneous.
It made me laugh out loud when you described what he looked like. Hey, you described him as looking like Frank Sinatra Jr.
Yes, well, when he's happy, he looks like Frank Sinatra Jr. on a tear. You know, so he's got a kind of, hey, you know, he used to make a noise that was, he'd made various noises over the years, but one of them was rah, 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 rah. And when he was in the Frank Sinatra Jr. mode, he would do the rah, 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 rah. He was, my wife actually took a photograph of him once, and he looked like Robert Evans, you know, the producer, the
right.
Famous producer who knew Natalie Wood and photographer was always talking like this, the whole kind of thing. And Walker I once put my sunglasses on and we took some photographs of him. In fact, there's a picture in the book of that.
Right.
And he almost became the Robert Evans of the CFC crowd. And it was, you know, I think we did those things, I mean, obviously not to make fun of him, but because you spend so much time feeling guilty, needlessly and pointlessly, because, of course, you know, we didn't cause this thing. It was a genetic mutation. And you spend so much time behind what my wife used to call the soundproof curtain of disability, where you just can't communicate it, that the chance to have fun and to, you know, be in a situation where we were laughing that any family might have, that meant a lot to us.
There's one thing that I take exception in the book. You killed Robert Evans. He's still with us.
Oh, did I? Did I say he was? He died?
Yeah, you mentioned that he's the late Robert Evans.
But are you sure he didn't die?
No, he had a stroke, I think.
Yeah, he had a stroke, but did he not die after that?
No, he's still alive. I checked Wikipedia and other places, and he's still with us.
Well, I'm sorry. Then that is that's inaccurate. I didn't mean to imply. I'll fix that if the next chance I get. I was sure he passed away, but maybe I offed him too quickly. I'm sorry.
The Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Chabon was on in November 2009 to discuss a collection he just published, Manhood for Amateurs. It's a great reflection on being a son, husband, and father, which is what we talked about in this clip. You write in the book that a father is a man who fails every day. Do you think that or know that, or does someone tell you that?
No, believe me, that is, you know, lived with wisdom, if you can call it wisdom. I mean, that is just a routine experience. You know, I think a mother is a woman who fails every day, for that matter. I mean, I think failure is a constant in the experience of raising children. You're always, you know, a day late and a dollar short. There's always a sense of insufficiency, no matter how much time and attention you lavish on your children, if you can manage to do that, you know, it's not, they'll take more. It's never enough. They're sort of a bottomless hole, and as much attention as you pour into it, they will never be filled. And what's more, you know, you're trying to hold your children to kind of a standard of behavior and conduct, to raise them up to be good and decent people who take other people's feelings into consideration, before they act and that sort of thing. You know, but on the other hand, you're also, you know, nobody's perfect and nobody really lives up to the standards, and so you're failing at that all the time, and your kids are witnessing that failure, and so then you also have this whole hypocrisy element thrown into it where you're saying, you know, do as I say, not as I do.
I readily admit to not being much of a fiction reader, but over the years a great number of big-time novelists have appeared on the program, including Wayne Johnston, Joy Fielding, Linwood Barclay, Nam Lee, David Bergen, Nino Ricci, Miriam Taves, Elizabeth Hay, and a great many others. Perhaps I ought to do a clip show of just the writers. But here are some, beginning with the Booker Prize winner Kiran Desai.
When you go into writing a book, I guess if you don't think about the themes in particular, what do you go into the book or go into the story thinking of? Like what's the goal, I suppose?
You're really getting to the heart of my embarrassment. when I'm working, and I was working on this book, it's very different from my first book. I had no plot, no plan, and I was working in what you could call a really a mystical fashion. You know, I was not noticing time passing by, and 8 years passed by, so a significant amount of time, and I wrote everything that came into my mind. I mean, one day it might just have been the look of the landscape, you know, or something very small. The thought of a frog in a water tank high up above the bamboo in an old house in the mountains. Just treating it like a line of poetry, maybe. And one thought leading to the next, one idea leading to the next, one character to the next, across national boundaries, and going back and forth in time. And I wasn't thinking of it as a novel. I was forcing the habit of writing, I suppose. So writing was my life entirely. My writing did not exist separately. It was all the same thing, which is quite unhealthy, but really wonderful, I think, for a writer. And the novel was almost beside the point. I lifted it out of about 1,500 pages, I think about 6 years or 6 or 7 years into the book.
William Deverill on Canadian Books.
I think we tend to emphasize too much the so-called literary, unquote, books in Canada. And those, it's to those that the awards go. It's those that somehow usually get reviewed. There's a lot of great writing, genre writing, that is not, considered eligible for such as the Giller Award or the Governor General's Award. And I make that point that we still have a colonial mentality inherited from our provenance as a colony of Britain, and we can't seem to decide, as the Americans have managed to do. They lionize their crime writers, their science fiction writers, and of course the British knight them, but we treat them like in-laws tramping dirt into the kitchen.
Alan Bradley on reading and books.
And by the time I actually did get to school in grade two, having spent this entire year in bed, I was reading all of the books that we had in the house. I was reading Mark Twain and that sort of thing, some Book of the Month Club things that someone had around the house. And my grandmother was the same. She was always ready to put into your hand. She used to say, any book that you ever need to read in your life will find you. And I would go over and pester her for something to read, and I can clearly remember her giving me Dorothy Sayers' Busman's Honeymoon. I can even, as I'm talking to you, I can see the black linen hardcover binding of the book and the letters on the spine.
Any book you will ever need to read will find you.
Yes.
God, what a wonderful phrase that is.
Isn't that great? And,
yeah.
And I found it to be true. There have been so many cases where I would be doing research on something and I would go into a secondhand bookstore that I might have been in dozens of times before, and a book would virtually leap into your hand, something that you desperately needed. And occasionally a book that you didn't even know yet that you needed, you would buy it just on some weird hunch, and lo and behold, within a day or a week or a month, it would be the one book in the world that you couldn't do without.
K.
Karen Connolly on Burma.
How did you end up in Burma?
I went to Burma the first time, partly because I was very interested in the case of a young woman writer who had been imprisoned for 20 years in solitary confinement. I mean, that was her sentence. She hadn't been in that long yet. She'd been maybe in prison for 4 or 5 years when I found out about her. And her crime was writing short stories that were critical of the military regime. Her name is Matida, and happily, years later, she was, in fact, amnestied and released, and I met her, and I was just talking to her a few days ago. We became quite good friends, but that's the original reason. I wanted to find out more about Matida's situation. We shared many similarities. We were both young women, writers, you know, in our late 20s, interested in social justice issues, and I was free, living my adventurous life, and Matida was in solitary confinement in a prison in Burma. So I was just really struck by the accident of geography that defines a life, and it made me curious about her, it made me curious about Burma. And once I had gone that first time, I was hooked. I fell in love with Burma.
Here's Waisen Choi on Playing the Lottery.
Say, do you still buy lottery tickets?
Yes, I do. Because how can I not? Because I've always felt myself lucky, and in Paper Shadows, I discuss how that worked for me. And I can't explain it. And I don't go crazy, by the way. I don't see it as much as a superstition, as a kind of intuition. I felt lucky that I should buy tickets at this one particular store across from the hospital where my father was resting in 1982. And I bought a ticket that won $100,000 just when we needed it, because it was during that recession in the 1980s. And I had to even do without my car. We were kind of down and out. Had to get a house to shelter my father. And that's when Carl and Marie joined me to buy the house, and they became a family members of my father's care. I mean, I was just very lucky. And then we got breathing room from the lottery ticket. So, yeah, I feel lucky now and then. I've won a few small $1,000 here and there. But somebody said the way, you know, you play, how could you lose? At some point, you've got to win, you know. And I play because I say anytime it hits over $25 million, let's put in $1 or $2 and have a daydream.
The noted Canadian broadcaster Mary Lou Finley was on the program in December 2008. At the end of our chat on her book about As It Happens, the program she hosted for a number of years, I asked her about leaving the show.
Why did you leave the show? It's been 3 years now, has it?
Mm-hmm. I just felt it was time, James. I just, I was beginning to get tired. It's as much fun as it is and as engrossing as it is to host. It's also, it uses up a lot of energy. So I felt that it was probably time for somebody fresh to come in and take the helm before I got completely exhausted.
This is a wonderful book, and congratulations on doing it. Continued good luck with it.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you. Did I call you James?
Hey, you did, yes.
I'm very sorry.
No, that's
fine.
Thank you, Joseph. Yeah, thanks very much.
Okay.
Okay, have a good day. Bye-bye.
The last clip is from an interview I did in April of 2006. It's with the television reporter Mike Leonard. He files regular pieces for NBC's Today Show, and he was on to discuss a book he'd written on taking his parents across America via RV. I get him to recount a story about the ring he gave his wife. It's a wonderful story.
You know, as I said before, since I got my job in TV by making home movies, this was 10 years earlier. I didn't get into TV till I was 30, and I had been making movies all those early, you know, all through my 20s. But we didn't have any money, and so making home movies was a really kind of a stretch for our income, for our budget and stuff like that, just buying the film. But 10 years earlier, when I was working construction in the city of Chicago, the summer between my junior and senior year of college. And I was a hockey player in college, and I was going back for my last year, and I was saving up for a wedding ring, living in a YMCA, actually, because my parents had moved out west. And I had saved $1,000 by the end of the summer and planned to buy my wife an engagement ring, my wife-to-be, that weekend. And I called my parents to tell them that I was going to ask Kathy to marry me. And my dad put my grandmother on, and my grandmother said, I want to give you my mother's ring. And she had been saving this ring for the first boy to get married, and of course I didn't know that because, you know, family of four boys, we don't talk about rings or anything. So, and my grandmother's mother was from Ireland, her name was Bridget O'Halloran, she was another immigrant, and when my dad got back on the phone, I said, well, that's terrific, but how do I get the ring? It's Friday, and I have to get proposed, I have to propose the next day or two and then go back to school on Monday. And so my dad said, let me think of something, and the next day, or he said, beware, there's a phone tomorrow, because I didn't have a phone at the YMCA, and he called me at my wife's house, my wife's parents' house. And he said, go to the airport. And what my dad had done is that he had taken this diamond ring from this, you know, long-dead Irish immigrant woman and brought it to the airport in Phoenix and waited at the departure lounge, which you can't do these days because of security, and waited for the first flight attendant to come by. And he said, excuse me, could you bring this ring to my son? And she was a stranger, and he handed the ring to her. And then when he called me, he said, she has brown hair. You know, he didn't even have her name. So, you know, the flight could have been delayed or canceled, and then who knows what would have happened because she didn't know his name. But the flight did arrive, and I was there waiting for it, and the flight attendant came up to me after everybody emptied out of the plane and said, you must be the boy. And I said, I think I am. And she took the ring out and gave it to me and gave me a hug and said, have a wonderful life, and walked away. And, you know, it was interesting because that ring came across with this woman from Ireland who trusted to have a good life in America. And then my dad trusted the stranger to bring it back across America to this kid waiting at an airport. And then, because I now had the ring and the $1,000, I left the airport and went out and bought a movie camera, which was the remarkable part because I hadn't been thinking about a movie camera. But the ring gave me the camera, and the camera gave me the job. And the job, you know, put me in this position to write the book. So this long dead woman, this Bridget O'Halloran's gift, really has changed the course of my life.
And that's 6 years of the On the Line program. Thank you for suffering through this look back. It was a pain in the ass to cull these clips, listen to them again, edit them, arrange them, and script the show. Not to mention a chore to read all the books, take notes, and prepare for all these interviews over the last 6 years. However, in the end, for me, it's been a remarkable experience, rewarding, and admittedly fun. I'm proud of the program and pleased there's an audience for it. Since I've yet to and will unlikely win an award for this program, permit me now to acknowledge and thank the many, many people who are involved in an endeavor such as this. The guests themselves deserve individual thanks. Hopefully I've thanked them all at the beginning or end of the interview, or both. Foremost, my friend and colleague Vishal Durr has been a steadfast and stalwart support technically. I thank him again. Early on, I was assisted by Richie Leung. He was there at the beginning of the program and deserves acknowledgement. I also acknowledge the many others whose efforts aren't as conspicuous, who've either emailed or called to suggest a guest or a topic, who've arranged, planned, booked, and perhaps even corralled the guests to be at the other end of my telephone over the years. These nameless, faceless folks have been a necessary part of this program and deserve much acknowledgement and heartfelt thanks. My family and friends who encourage and support me, I thank publicly now. I've always wanted to end the program with this. Good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are. I guess I just did. I'll be back in September with more. Until then, I'm Joseph Planta.